There are so many women out there that are taking a stand against gender inequality and are paving the way for the future generation. Ordinary women that are creating a more inclusive and powerful society, free from stereotypes, racism and sexism. And I'm here to share their stories with all of you. Stay tuned, because this is WEN Power, your source of inspiring, powerful and positive stories. And I'm here to discover how we can change the narrative, one story at a time. I am your host, Ilaria Biancacci, journalist and founder of WEN Power.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of WEN Power Podcast. We are here at Key's house in Battersea with Katrina French. She is the founder and director of Unjust CNC, which is an organization that challenges discriminatory practice and policies within the UK policing and wider criminal justice system. Thank you, Katrina, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for accepting to share your story and experience with WEN Power audience. Let's just dive straight into it. And I want to ask you, what is that you're fighting for today?
Racial equality, fairness, accountability, for humanity, essentially.
So how did Unjust came to life, and what is that drove you to take this decision?
Yeah, so to be honest, if we'd been speaking a year ago, it wasn't at all in my mind. But a lot happened last year. We saw the untimely death, actually the murder of George Floyd. We were in a global pandemic and the police were continuing to police in a really heavy-handed manner. It didn't seem as though they were considering the public health approach that they so much spoke about. And then I had, out of all of that though, a very successful year at Stopwatch in terms of I launched a GoFundMe campaign in July. June, in response to George Floyd's murder. And the aspiration around that was about shining a light on policing issues here in the UK. Whilst I wholeheartedly support the global movement, I feel that what happens here in the UK is that we're always shining a light on other places and not looking closer at home. So I was really keen to engage with the public around the policing issues here and put this GoFundMe together. And it led to us raising unprecedented amount for the organisation, in excess of £100,000. And I think as that happened, I started to recognise that there were other issues in policing that needed to be addressed. And I stepped away from Stopwatch in December and I wanted to stay in the field of criminal justice. So one day I was actually in the shower and this idea came to me, Unjust. And I was like, okay, what am I going to do? And then it was a strap line, right and wrong, creating equity. So the idea was that I would do what I was doing at Stopwatch, but just broaden my remit and my focus in a way. So yeah, it came from a year of a lot of global turmoil, a year of personal growth, professional accomplishment, and then saying if I can do it for other people, I can definitely do it for myself. So yeah, that's how it came about. It was really organic. I honestly sometimes don't know how I sit here now, a year later, after everything that's gone on, and think like I'm so blessed to have an organisation that I'm leading, but also that it's developing and growing day by day.
So what is what you're working on at the moment, and who is in with you in this new adventure?
Okay, so my co-director is a man called Gary Dwyer. He's in property development, but as a first-generation black British man, he had experienced over policing. So he was really keen to support and give back to the community. So he sits on the board, and then there's myself, and we have an array of volunteers that are giving their time. And I think it's really beautiful when you see people becoming empowered and feeling like they can become part of the change. So at the moment, we're focusing on stop and search, specifically looking at the police crime courts. Yeah, the police crime sentencing and courts bill and the introduction of a new policing power to stop and search. We're really concerned around mental health and policing. And there was the death of Kevin Clark, a man who was having a mental health episode and ended up being restrained by the police and losing his life. So we're really keen to shine a light on issues that don't just result in death, that actually there's lots of people that are harmed, whether that be psychologically or physically, when they're in mental health episodes. because of the police response, so we want to shine a light on that. Looking at drug law enforcement, so the disparity in how drug policy is exercised in Black, Asian, ethnic minority communities and working class communities. So speaking about having an evidence-based approach to drugs as opposed to personal positions from politicians who are quite hypocritical about drug use. And then what else are we looking at? Policing technology and how we're seeing new equipment being introduced and what are some of the data harms that aren't being discussed because of these new mechanisms. So whether it be biometric fingerprint scanner or the mobile phone extraction devices or facial recognition technology, it just feels that all of this is going on and there isn't sufficient challenge outside of the civil society, that communities just don't know what's happening and it's wrong. So we're focusing our research on those areas, and then we deliver services to professionals and young people and children.
What are you doing? I think it's really important as well for what you mentioned before. We're coming after a year of huge challenges from a human perspective, political perspective, everything that happened around us. It kind of like, we need to shed this light and we need to show people what is really happening. So what you want to do with Unjust and what you're actually really doing, I think it's really, really important. So I want to say thank you for taking the lead in this topic and to really give an opportunity as well to young people to come on board with you and actually make a change. When we talk about racial injustice in the UK, it's not a new topic. It's been going on probably forever. And I read that the UK Parliament's Human Rights Committee did a poll talking to Black people and asking how they feel about police, and 85% felt threatened or scared, or and they are not even confident when they are approached by police forces. So, how do you feel about this, and what do you think can be changed, if can be changed?
I think my first thought is it's very saddening. It's not shocking. It's saddening that, as you know, the public, as people living here in this country for now generations, the relationship, it's not the relationship between Black people and the police. I feel that language makes it seem as though the community's done something wrong. It's the state racism and the institutional discrimination that has led to people feeling the umbrage that they feel. So I feel that the context is really important as to why that 85% is there. I recently spoke to someone, they were saying, oh, the anti-police sentiment comes from America. And it dawned on me that so few people understand the historical relationship of Black people being over-policed by police. So not all surprised by that. In terms of what could be done, or I know there needs to be acknowledgement for the wrongs that have been caused and the wrongs that then continue to be caused by over-policing, by racial profiling, by targeting socioeconomic poor areas with a certain sort of policing, that the state or politicians or senior police officers just isn't willing to say. So I think that's part of the problem, is that if you have leadership that don't acknowledge that there is a problem, how can you address the problem? And then that's the starting point for me, is an honest conversation about what's gone wrong, instead of the usual defensive rhetoric that comes out around, we need to protect you.
Do you think it's also a matter of representation? Because when we talk about leadership, if the leadership doesn't include all the voices of a community, obviously we're going to face the same obstacles over and over again. So do you think maybe with a representation that includes all groups, all voices of a community, an actual change can be achieved a little bit faster, or maybe in a more in the more right way?
I think two things. So if we're talking about the police changing, so when we say often people are speaking about the police being more inclusive and more representative, and I'm a strong believer that if somebody wants to pursue a career in law enforcement, then that's their personal choice. However, looking to America, don't see having more Black officers as having any significant change on the policies and the procedures that are being fought out. So I think there is something around supporting people to live their best life, to do the things that they want to do. However, I think it's more than just representation and inclusion. It comes back to an acknowledgement from the people who are upholding the system that you haven't been doing things right and things need to change, as opposed to just more black and brown people joining the police. The flip side of that is I think that the police crime sentencing bill and sentencing courts bill has been fantastic in mobilising communities together. So we've got Gypsy, Traveller, Roma communities. I'm on a platform with that I hadn't necessarily had the level of engagement with prior to the bill. There's been, you know, Sisters Uncut. There's been groups that have come up through the Serve Everard stuff. So there's definitely, and Prevent, the Muslim community, through all of, you know, legislation that went through under terrorism, and obviously the black community with sus laws and so forth, that there is now much more of a collective understanding of over-policing. My kind of apprehension though is, for the people that know about it and own it, like myself, it will be like that. But for people that just dip in, I just think there needs to be more of a dialogue for people to understand that it's not topical, this is ongoing, and it requires ongoing commitment to fix it. That's kind of my perspective on how things could be changed, and how coming together and having unity and solidarity is definitely stronger in the community sense, as opposed, in my opinion, to saying, oh, we need more black people in the police.
I mean, this is also what happened when we talk about gender quota or gender representation. Sometimes when you are on the line of, like, we want to be more inclusive and diverse, then you tend to forget the focus of all of this. It's not just because I'm going to hire more women, more minorities representative or so on, things will change. It obviously can give an opportunity, because the personalities are different around the table, ideas are different, there is more creativity, different experiences as well, but it doesn't have to take away the focus from the main subject, which is, like you say, it's not something that is happening just now, and so then we need to target it now and fix it just with a patch. It's something that we need to work on, like consistency.
Yeah, exactly that. I think representation definitely matters in, you know, being inclusive, but ultimately it's about being anti-racist. It's about being pro-equity, pro-equality. It's about systems change. Mm-hmm. And unless your organisations or institutions are willing to do that systemic work, all you're doing is tokenism, performative stuff. And I feel people should take those positions because they're just good for their personal growth and we need people in them. But I don't think that's the panacea for fixing the system.
Of course. For everyone that is listening to us today, and maybe they are not really familiar with crime and prevention laws, we mentioned already the SAS law, Section 6, Stop and Search. Would you like just to explain a little bit more how this works on the ground and how it's affecting communities, and what are you actually doing as well to challenge it?
So most people would have heard of Stop and Search, just because it's, you know, the police go to tool whenever there's a serious violence offence. However, Stop and Search is primarily used for drug searches, so that's the primary reason that police use Stop and Search, despite the kind of outward rhetoric that it's used mainly for serious violence and knife crime. And basically enables the police to stop, search, detain someone on the roadside and check whether they have any prohibited articles on their persons. And this means that they don't have to be arrested unless they do have something they shouldn't have. And it came from the birth of the SUS law, which was in place up until 1981, and it enabled the police to stop, search, arrest anybody that they suspected to have committed an offence. And my understanding is all it took was two officers to corroborate that they had seen or believed somebody to have committed an offence, and that person could be found guilty and actually imprisoned. And in the 1970s and 80s, the SUS law was disproportionately applied to black and brown communities, specifically the black Caribbean community, and it led to the over-criminalisation of swathes of black men and boys in that area. After the Brixton insurrection in 1981, the Scarman report was published, and it highlighted the tensions that had been growing through the SUS law, and the state subsequently got rid of the SUS laws and introduced Stop and Search, which was meant to be more proportionate because police officers needed to have reasonable grounds to carry out the search. Well, what we've seen in the last 35 years, because it's been in action for 35 years, is that racial disparity has continued to increase. So despite it meaning it's meant to replace what was a discriminatory law that had been on the statute book since, I think it's the 1800s, it actually hadn't been used very much, but when the kind of Windrush population came in, they started having children, the state started to use that law. So now we see 35 years later, in my opinion, a morphing of the institutional racism and the tactics of the state to socially control specific groups. And I say that I do believe that stop and search would have some value if it wasn't being used in the way that it is used. People are racially profiled, it's efficient expedition police for police officers, and about 76% of the time there's no further action taken. So that means the person is free to go. Very alarmed that we are doing maybe 500,000 stops and 76% of them, people have nothing on them. In my opinion, it's a huge waste of police resources. It's very intrusive to be stopped and searched on the roadside, embarrassing. And also the human financial cost for the person being stopped. You could be on your way to work, you could be doing something, and you're sometimes with the police for up to an hour. So overall, it's time for stop and search to be... I don't believe it should be scrapped, if I'm honest. I feel that if it's done in the right way, there's room for it in our society. However, it's not being done in the right way, so we really need to revisit it and look at not just the harms, but how police officers should be doing their jobs, and if they're not doing their jobs properly, they shouldn't be doing their jobs.
And you also talk about the stop and search in Progressive Review. You wrote a paper. Would you like to just add anything else to what we just said?
So I had the kind of privilege of being invited to contribute to the IPPR Progressive Review. It's the summer edition. Race on the Agenda were the guest editors, I believe, and I'm close associates with the CEO there, Maurice McLeod, and he was kind enough to say, "Katrina, would you like to be part?" So I did. I penned a short piece, and it was just highlighting the efficacy around stop and search, touching on the impact, and I suppose setting the scene for what needs to be different. And I spoke in the article about empowering communities to be part of structures, however, recognizing that the structures as they are aren't fit for purpose. So you can't ask people to back things that just aren't working because they get disillusioned. Not even they get disillusioned, they wake up, they're not disillusioned, they're very much aware that this is a disillusion and they disengage, and I completely understand why. So if we are gonna hold the police to account, it needs to be led by people that have been negatively impacted by that, as opposed to people who have no lived experience around adverse policing and just the damage that can cause.
When we talk about crime, justice, racial injustice, we can't leave behind the new generation as well, and how we can I would not even say educate them, but how can we make them more aware of what is out there and how they should reply or how they should act in certain circumstances? And there is something that maybe you as unjust, you're planning to do in schools, educational centers, youth centers,
Yeah, so that's definitely part of our mission and our, I suppose, a strapline, right and wrong, creating equity. So lots of our work is looking at policy, briefings, advocacy, much more formal structured writing. However, knowing what I know is that policy takes forever to change and people can't wait for policy to change to feel empowered. So we do offer programs, so different sorts of workshops and courses for people to build their understanding around the issue, but not just their understanding and confidence, but allyship. Mm-hmm. So we deliver to children and young people. We have an informed and empowered program that we deliver to children and young people, whether it be via voluntary sector settings or schools. And then we have a rights, responsibility and welfare program, which is delivered to adults and practitioners. And I suppose the idea is that whilst young people are the people that are disproportionately stopped, 14 to 25 year olds, when in terms of stop and search, I'm a strong believer that we need a holistic view to support them. In my last role, I never had a child call me to say they wanted to report or stop. It was always an adult. And I feel that there was a bit of a gap in how we support parents to support their children through those spaces. So the knowledge base is really key, the confidence to engage, having a network or being connected to an organisation that can advocate on your behalf or refer you to good legal support, I believe makes having to, I don't want to say challenge, but respond, because it's not, it's challenging, but sometimes it's not you. I think the language is usually framed in a way that it makes the black people seem really anti-police, but it's not. You're responding and upholding your rights. You're basically making sure, holding the state to account. But when you speak about challenge, it seems as though you're being disruptive. You're not doing as you should be told. And in some ways, there is a disruption because what's going on is so wrong. It's really important that we have spaces where people can come and learn from each other, feel that they are connected to people that care, and that they're aware of the work that we're doing. One of the other things we offer is a training for people on scrutiny panels so that they can understand the history of policing and some of the questions that they may want to be asking, how they can look at the data sets that the police provide to ensure that when they are providing that scrutiny mechanism, it's robust and they're not just, once again, performative and tick box exercises for the police.
Going back to how you settle unjust, many of the women that listen to this podcast are either entrepreneurs themselves or the founders of organization, or they are thinking about creating something on their own. What advice would you give them if they are deciding to set up something for themselves, a business and a social enterprise or anything, also based on your experience of I should have done that in another way, or I wish I knew that before? What kind of advice would you give them?
I think my journey has been one that has been highly blessed and highly favoured, just in terms of, I would never have imagined I was sitting here now leading my own organisation. I have great leadership skills, but I didn't see myself as the builder of my business or a non-profit. I was very much committed to working for others and serving others in a way that, I didn't necessarily believe I had the confidence or the capacity. So I suppose what I'm talking about here is imposter syndrome, or I can't do it. And I think last year showed me, there was a light bulb moment of, if other people can see my light, how can I not see it? And if I'm doing this for others, why can I not do it for myself? And I can only liken it to, someone gives you the keys to a house in my CEO position, you've just got to kind of put a new kitchen in, do the walls, and you do a very good job at that renovation. And then the next thing you decide is to buy some land and say you're going to build your own house. And it can be incredibly daunting. I think my advice would be to prepare, to plan, to prepare, to reach out to your network. If you are entering a space that you don't have a network, start speaking to friends, start attending webinars, start putting your foot in the door. I think it's really important to be visible in the field you like to be in. I've been fantastically supported by an organization called Tremenco, who gave support around building the business and the idea. I think sometimes we can be in our own heads a lot, least of all in a world now where everything's remote. Find your tribe and share your information with people that you believe can help you with your, I don't like to call it dreams, your targets, your goals. Mm-hmm. And dreams sound a bit lofty. And don't be scared to make mistakes. We're all growing, and unless you try, you won't ever succeed, and you can never fail unless you try. So I'm a strong believer, just do it, learn from it. All that can go wrong is that it doesn't work, and if it doesn't work, you'll find something else to do anyway. And support each other. I've been so blessed to be supported by other women along this journey. So people like Neve Eastwood at Release have been just absolutely fantastic, like Temi Mwale at the Forefront Project, another sister who's been fantastic. And then I'm coming to new spaces around mental health, so people like Marcia Rigg I've called up, or Lynette Charles, and said, like, this isn't my specialism, but I really want to be in this area. How do I build my knowledge base? So I suppose collaboration, and knowing that many hands make light work, but equally have the confidence to do it, you know, just to trust yourself to do it. You've come this far. That's the kind of advice I'd give, but it feels weird giving it because my journey was as a volunteer on a scrutiny panel working for local government in a very good job. My salary was good, I had very good benefits, and then I left that to go to a CEO position where, yeah, there were less benefits, to be fair, in terms of the remuneration. You couldn't go any higher because you were the CEO, so you'd reached the pinnacle. So complete shift from going from being an employee leaving on the dot at kind of 5:36 to doing sometimes like a 10-hour day and juggling everything. But an absolutely beautiful experience that has given me the fortitude, but also the confidence and knowledge to be able to now do that unjust.
And adding to this, if there was just any advice you would like to share with women, with men, with everyone that is listening?
Yeah, be kind to yourself. Like, this is a journey we're on. Be kind to yourself on this journey, especially after the year that we've had. Just be really kind to yourself. Set yourself your goals and do the best that you can do. It sounds really airy-fairy, but I think those are the things. It's just be kind to yourself, have some goals and go out and do them. And when someone says no, I use it as fuel for turning it into a yes. So if someone says no, just keep going along until you get that yes.
At the beginning of this interview, I ask you what you're fighting for. So I would like just to finish by asking you, what is that you wish to don't fight for anymore?
Yeah, well, yeah, I must say that the kind of big wish, and I often speak with Brian Channer, he's director at the Black Policy Institute, a very good friend of mine, and I don't want to have to fight for freedom. I'm still to fight for freedom. Freedom should just be given. It's a birthright. You shouldn't have to fight for it. And when you do, it's tiring and it's really costly. And least of all, as a black woman, there's lots of discrimination in that. So yeah, I really wish I didn't have to fight for freedom because I'm a strong believer it's a birthright. So yeah.
Well, thank you very much for sharing all of this incredible information with us, your story, your experience. I want to say thank you as well to Brian Channer from the Black Policy Institute. He is the connection between us, is the man that brought us together. He's an ally as well. And I'm very grateful to have you here today, and I hope you enjoy it, and I hope to see you again soon with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If this was your first time listening to When Power Podcast, thank you for taking the time. You can find us on Podbean and Spotify. Subscribe to our newsletter on wenpower.co and keep up to date with all the future projects on all our social media at WenPowerUK. Thank you to all the women out there that are following and supporting WenPower. I will continue to bring to you powerful, inspiring and positive stories from all over the world. Don't forget, together we empower women. This is Ilaria for When Power Podcast. Until next time.